Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm John Ronson, and I'm back with Season 2 of Things Fell Apart, my show for BBC Radio 4 that unearths the origin stories of the culture wars. This time around, the stories are all about the battlefronts that engulfed us during lockdown. The stories twist and turn until each one ends with the explosion of a new, far-reaching culture war.
If you tell me that my nephew had superhuman strength, if you tell me that he didn't feel any pain, well, he's dead now.
That's Things Fell Apart. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 16th of January, these are our main stories. A large US-owned container ship is hit by a Houthi missile off the coast of Yemen as Britain defends Western airstrikes.
Those strikes that we conducted have been successful in the specific targets that were selected.
Israel rejects Hamas's claims one of its airstrikes killed two hostages shown dead in a video released by the group. And a warning about the growing gap between rich and poor as a world first is predicted, the trillionaire.
Nobody should have $1 billion, let alone $1 trillion. This is not the kind of economy that we need to overcome poverty.
Also in this podcast, the case of the Italian culture minister and the stolen 17th century painting. And one of the world's best known video game franchises is back.
Per de ciò vi don be peace.
A culturally sensitive Prince of Persia. Houthi rebels in Yemen have confirmed that they carried out a ballistic missile strike on a US container ship. The Gibraltar Eagle reported no injuries or significant damage and continued its journey. The attack by the Houthis follows last week's US-led airstrikes against them. The Iranian-backed group has been attacking ships since November in protest at Israel's war with Hamas. Addressing the British Parliament about the US and UK mission, the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak told MPs the government was backing words with action.
Those strikes that we conducted have been successful in the specific targets that were selected during the strikes. Obviously, that's an initial assessment, but that remains our case at the moment. And more generally, what we want to see is a reduction of tensions in the region and a restoration of stability.
Attacks by Houthi rebels in protest at the war in Gaza on commercial vessels have resulted in many firms deciding to avoid one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. For an update on the attack, I spoke to our correspondent Hugo Boshega, who's covering the story from Beirut.
Alex, the US military issued a statement saying that this commercial vessel was hit by an anti-ship ballistic missile. There was no significant damage, and the ship now is continuing its journey. The US military said this happened just hours after another anti-ship ballistic missile was fired by the Houthis. This missile landed in an area inside Yemen, so it didn't hit any vessel. But I think this shows that the Houthis continue to have the ability to fire and hit vessels in the Red Sea. So this shows that the Houthis continue to pose a significant threat to vessels in the Red Sea.
So what do we know about those strikes that were carried out by the US and the UK? Have we any more detail on what they achieved?
We're talking about dozens of airstrikes, 60 targets hit in nearly 30 locations in Yemen. US officials in Britain have been saying the attacks have been successful. And they say that these attacks were to guarantee freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. We heard from Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, who addressed Parliament. He made this point. And as you said in the introduction, these attacks have caused major disruption to global trade because the Red Sea has been effectively closed. Ships are having to go through the Cape of Good Hope in Africa, adding costs to the journeys, 10 extra days to those journeys. And there have been concerns about the economic impact of those attacks. So the Americans and the British defending those attacks as trying to prevent an escalation in the region. But what the Houthis are saying is that these attacks are an escalation on Israel's behalf, because they say that they've been carrying out these attacks to protest against Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. And they say that these attacks are going to continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza.
Hugo Bashega. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, has been looking at what options are now open to the Houthis and how they could keep targeting shipping in the Red Sea.
The Houthis, who control most of the populated parts of Yemen, now have three options. They can choose to back down, having made their point about supporting Hamas, raise their regional profile, and increase their popularity at home. Their actions to date show no sign of them doing this, in fact, quite the opposite. They can continue to harass military and commercial shipping off their coasts, firing off the occasional missile. This is what they appear to be doing now, with recent attacks aimed at vessels off the coastal cities of Hodeidah and Aden. Or, and this is the option the West should worry about, they could marshal their remaining missiles and drones and wait for the opportunity to launch a mass attack on a US or British warship in the hopes of overwhelming its air defences. This is something the Houthi spokesman has already hinted at, and it remains a real risk. US intelligence assesses that the recent airstrikes on the Houthis' military facilities have destroyed or seriously degraded at least a quarter of their missile arsenal. Further airstrikes will degrade that. So the Houthis, possibly in consultation with their Iranian backers, will need to make some careful calculations as to how far they take this beyond their fiery rhetoric about retaliation.
Frank Gardner. Hamas has released a new video which claims to show the bodies of two dead Israeli hostages. Hamas blamed Israeli airstrikes for their deaths, a claim which is impossible to verify. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Wira Davis, told me more.
Ever since this crisis began, and one feature of it was that more than 200 Israelis and other nationalities were taken hostage by Hamas to Gaza, was that they released videos initially as a proof of life to show that they were still alive. The tactic has always been, when they produce these videos, to try and persuade the Israelis to call a ceasefire, because that, according to Hamas, is the only way to guarantee the safety of the hostages. But this video has been particularly sinister, say the Israelis, and a very difficult one for the families of the hostages, because it was released in three tranches. The first one, about 24 hours ago, just showed three hostages speaking to camera. We couldn't tell when it was taken. A second video released this morning showed the three hostages again, but suggested that they may be dead, and it invited people to wait till tonight to find out. And then tonight, a third video has been released showing the bodies of two male hostages. And the third hostage, a female, is reading out a statement, and you can see clearly that she's reading out a statement. These videos are filmed under duress, saying that they were killed in Israeli airstrike. So the message is clear from Hamas, if not brutal, saying that Israel must stop its campaign against Hamas targets in Gaza for the hostages to be released safely. And I think it will certainly increase public pressure in Israel, which sees the release of the hostages as an absolute priority over and above the military objective.
Yeah, I'm just seeing on the Reuters wire an Israeli military spokesperson saying the hostage purported dead in the Hamas video was not killed by Israeli fire. Have you heard anything else that the Israelis are saying about this?
No, it's impossible to say how the hostages were killed. Hamas claims that they were killed in an airstrike simply cannot be verified. And certainly Israel would hold Hamas responsible for the safety and welfare of the hostages, whatever conditions they're being held in. But of course, this comes in a wider context. You know, another 150 people were killed in Gaza today in Israeli airstrikes, say the Hamas-run health ministry, and bringing the number of dead in Gaza to 24,000. So this is war that's affecting many people on all sides.
Wira Davis. Staying with the conflict and the events leading up to the October the 7th attacks on Israel, a unit of young female Israeli soldiers stationed on the border with Gaza to look for signs of anything suspicious had warned of a major assault, but they were unheard, as the BBC's Alice Cuddy explained to Lukwesa Burak.
We've been looking specifically at these units of young female officers that are based very close to the Gaza border. Their job is basically to watch hours of live surveillance footage, looking out for anything that they think is suspicious. They're known in Israel as the eyes of the state. In the run-up to October 7th, a number of them have told us that they did begin to see things that were giving them reason to have suspicions, but they say that these warnings were not being heard.
So what did they observe?
Training by Hamas. They saw them building within Gaza model Israeli tanks that they would then practice how to take over. They were also practicing raids and kidnapping. Separately, they were saying people were planting bombs near the fence, which they believe was to test its strength. One young soldier, Ronnie, told us that she saw vans of Hamas fighters who were passing watch posts on the other side of the fence, carefully inspecting it, taking photos. They saw an increase in what they describe as an attempted border incursion. Also, they say they saw what they're describing as suspicious behaviour from farmers and bird catchers on the other side of the fence. They were moving closer, these people's faces were changing, and they believe that they were collecting intelligence ahead of the attacks.
What's the significance of the IDF using women in this role?
Women have always done this role. They've always been in this unit. It's young women because of conscription in Israel, so they tend to be in their late teens to early 20s. Some people have speculated that part of the reason these women were not listened to is linked to chauvinism in the IDF. None of the women that we spoke to were really making that allegation. They said that the reason that they believe they were not listened to is because they're at the bottom of the rung in the military. One of them said, we're seen as eyes, we're not seen as soldiers.
This activity was first noticed back in May. Emails were then sent, I believe, around July time. Their managers, their bosses, how did they respond to their reports?
A number of them were saying Hamas is always preparing for an attack, but what they noticed in the run-up to October 7th was an increase in activity and an escalation also in the kinds of activity that they were seeing. Now they report suspicious activity to their direct commander, and also they can log it in a computer system on the base, where the idea is that it is then passed up to more senior elements of the military and to intelligence, who can then assess it. They say they didn't receive responses to the reports, that they don't know what was done with them. Most of the people we spoke to say they felt that it was being taken seriously within their base. They basically say that almost no response was fed back down to them. They were never told anything that was going on. These young women were not privy to broader intelligence that the military may have had access to. Beyond filing the reports, they have very little idea of what happened beyond that. And that's one of the questions that the surviving officers and that the families of those who were killed are now asking.
Some did pass away and some were taken hostage as well. When you spoke to these officers, what were their reflections on realising that their warnings had very much come true?
One woman, she was telling us she was not at the base on the morning of the attacks, but she woke up to WhatsApp messages from a group that she shared with other officers. And she said that the feeling that ran through her was, this is the thing that we've long feared is now happening. There's lots of questions among the people that we've been speaking to about why their warnings, they feel they weren't listened to, and also some anger from the families and surviving soldiers. More than a dozen of these surveillance soldiers were killed on October 7th. And as you say, others were taken hostage and several remain within Gaza. Several of these women said they were telling their families about their concerns in the run-up to October 7th.
Alice Cuddy. Now to a stark warning about artificial intelligence. A new report by the International Monetary Fund says that the technology will affect nearly 40% of all jobs across the world, and that figure rises to 60% in the advanced economies. My colleague James Copnall spoke to the BBC's business correspondent Zhuao De Silva in Singapore.
The most interesting point in this analysis is really a warning about the potential for AI to increase inequality across the board, whether it's between advanced and low-income countries, between young and old, skilled or low-skilled workers. The report says AI could widen the gap. It says the impact will be felt more dramatically in the advanced economies, where it says about 60% of jobs will be affected. Many workers in those countries will benefit from the technology, which will enhance their productivity and also their pay. But for many others, the impact will be far from positive. AI will be able to replace some jobs that are currently executed by humans. And in that way, it will lower demand for those jobs and lower pay for those jobs as well. The report also talks about the generational gap, with higher income and younger workers benefiting disproportionately from the adoption of AI, while lower income and older workers could fall behind.
Yeah. What sort of steps are being taken right now then to mitigate those negative impacts?
Well, this is a highly disruptive technology which is very much in its infancy and which is making quick and very unpredictable leaps in terms of how quickly it is developing. So policymakers and regulators are really playing catch up here. The EU has already reached a provisional deal which could lead to the world's first laws on AI already next year. But the US, the UK and China have yet to publish guidelines on this. But with growing public awareness about AI, there's also growing pressure on policymakers take action. So hopefully that happens on time to avoid the more negative effects that this report talks about.
João da Silva. Now, how rich is rich? At a time of growing wealth disparities worldwide, at least one answer is very rich indeed. And now the charity Oxfam has predicted that the world could soon have its first trillionaire. With more details, the newsroom's Sunita Nahar.
It's estimated that the scourge of poverty around the world would take 200 years to eradicate. But Oxfam predicts that it'll take just 10 years for the world to witness its first trillionaire. The charity says while 5 billion people were made poorer, the combined wealth of the world's top five richest men, including Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, has more than doubled from $405 billion in 2020 to more than $869 billion in 2023. Katie Chalrabotti is a spokeswoman for Oxfam.
No individual, no corporation should have this much power over our lives. Nobody should have $1 billion, let alone $1 trillion. This is not the kind of economy that we need to overcome poverty. It's not the kind of economy in which most people will thrive.
Oxfam says this disparity was supercharged by the pandemic, which created havoc in economies. And that meant that the developed countries could not provide financial aid to poorer nations. The group says action is needed and is calling on governments to reduce this widening gap between the ultra-rich and the poor by reining in corporate power.
And if you need reminding, a trillion has 12 zeros, a million million. Sunita Nahar with that report. Still to come in the Global News Podcast.
After this eruption that started yesterday, I don't think that we are ever going to be safe or feel safe in town again.
The Icelandic volcano that's left residents in Grindavik with a big dilemma about their future homes. The US President Joe Biden has congratulated Guatemala's new leader, Bernardo Arevalo, calling his inauguration on Monday a testament to our shared commitment to democracy and the will of the people. Mr. Biden said he looked forward to continuing the strong partnership between the two nations. On his first full day as president, Mr. Arevalo promised to fight corruption, but admitted he's expecting to face monumental challenges. Wearing the presidential sash across his chest, he said that many had worried that the country could be backsliding into dictatorship, but Guatemala's institutions had held strong.
We must take responsibility for the present, and the present in Guatemala offers us tremendous challenges that we can't ignore. Guatemala has suffered deep wounds that require healing.
The president won the election back in August, but has faced multiple attempts to prevent him from taking office. On Monday, the US said it planned to host Mr. Arevalo in Washington in the coming months in a show of support. So how crucial has the US's role been? Our Central America correspondent is Will Grant.
Pretty crucial, actually, I think. Washington has really, from the very moment that Bernardo Arevalo won, shown its backing to a calm and ordered passing of the baton. That, of course, hasn't taken place. There has been real obstacles put in place by lawmakers loyal to the outgoing administration, many of them accused of graft and corruption themselves, who are very, very concerned, it seems, about this anti-corruption platform that Mr. Adebalo ran on, and the feeling that he will make life very, very uncomfortable for those with investigations into them, and that there will be a sort of swing against some of the entrenched powers in what is one of the poorest nations in Central America.
Yeah, remind us of the attempts to stop him from becoming the head of state.
Well, there's been a variety, most of them legal challenges through a corrupt judicial system and individual judges and so on, loyal to the outgoing administration. What happened around the inauguration itself was extremely concerning, and a lot of people were worried when it just went on and on. The hours passed and he still hadn't been sworn in as president, that there would be some genuine attempt to stop him from taking power, that this was going to be some kind of attempt at coup d'etat. It didn't happen in the end, albeit 9 hours late he was sworn in.
Will Grant. Gaza is home to some of the oldest churches and mosques in the world, but many have not escaped the widespread destruction during Israel's continued bombardment of the region. The BBC World Service has established that 72 mosques, as well as 2 churches, have been destroyed or damaged between the 7th of October and the end of last year. Our global religion reporter, Reha Kansara, has been leading this investigation. Given that 1% of Gaza's population have lost their lives in the conflict, I asked her why this story about buildings matters.
Because it is under international humanitarian law defined as a war crime unless these religious buildings are being used for military purposes. Now, Israel's defense forces say that some of these mosques are being used by Hamas as military strongholds. So what we're seeing is an influx of mosques in particular and the damage of some churches in Gaza, which has led to many deaths.
Because presumably these buildings are still viewed by people who've lost everything as a place of sanctuary.
Yes, of course, and particularly for the Palestinian Christian community, churches have become a place to seek refuge. If you compare it to some of the scenes that are coming out of Rafah in the south of Gaza of plastic tents, at least you have a real roof over your head. You may have running water. The conditions are much better than some of these makeshift camps. Thus far, we haven't heard from the IDF that churches are being used by Hamas, but mosques in particular are being emphasized as Hamas strongholds by the IDF. We haven't been able to verify how many are Hamas strongholds. We don't have any data on that. We also don't know how many IDF have targeted, but we do know that overwhelmingly mosques are being targeted.
And some of these buildings, places with enormous history.
Yes, so for example, the Great Omari Mosque and St. Porphyrius Church, they are both in Gaza's old city. Experts have told me these ancient places of worship can be seen to be considered evidence that Palestinians existed on this land centuries ago.
Am I right to say that St. Porphyrius is the third oldest church in the world, isn't it?
Yes, it's considered to be the third oldest church in the world. It's still standing to this day. People who are sheltering there are attending Sunday Mass as they can under conditions of war.
And you've heard horror stories.
One lady I spoke to who is sheltering in St. Porphyrius Church, she fled there with her family and her husband, her child and her parents. Her brother-in-law died when an airstrike hit part of the outbuildings in the church's complex. And this has terrified her. She told me she's never seen a dead body before. He died saving his own child. She has a young one herself. And just recently, she had her baby baptized because she fears that her baby will also die without being baptized.
How did you go about collating this information?
The first instance was to look at Twitter day by day within our time frame, which was 7th October when the war began and 31st December, and find instances of mosques being destroyed or targeted. And so we were using search terms such as mosque, church, attacked, destroyed, Gaza. And then we would list the names of mosques or unknown mosques in Gaza that had been reportedly damaged or destroyed. And then we would go through verifying those using satellite imagery or we would use before and after pictures that came up on Twitter, now known as X, and comparing them to before pictures that are on Google. But it was a very lengthy process, which is why we kept our time frame of 7th October to 31st December.
I know you've tried to contact the Israeli military. Have you had any response on any of this?
We've had an initial response. The IDF say that Hamas militants are using places of worship as cover and a place to launch attacks from. But, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's really unclear how many of these religious sites that were verified have been destroyed by the IDF or how many are being used by Hamas. However, the IDF do say that they are acting in accordance with international law to dismantle Hamas's military and administrative capabilities and taking precautions to mitigate civilian harm.
Reha Kansara. Mauritius is experiencing heavy flooding as a tropical cyclone closes in on the Indian Ocean island after battering the nearby island of Reunion. The Mauritius Meteorological Services urged the public to stay in safe places with more torrential rain expected. Our Africa Regional Editor Richard Hamilton reports.
This footage posted on social media shows many cars in the capital, Port Louis, submerged under brown floodwater or piled up on the streets. Some people can be seen sitting stranded on the roofs of their vehicles, not daring to brave the waters. In Reunion, one person has died and around 600 others have been forced to leave their homes. Around a quarter of households there are without electricity and thousands have no running water. The authorities in Reunion had raised the storm alert level to violet, the highest level, as the cyclone approached. But it's now been downgraded to red to allow the security services to move around. Despite the dire warnings, Reunion appears to have been spared the worst of the cyclone as the eye of the storm passed further to the north.
Richard Hamilton. As you may have heard in a previous Global News podcast, Iceland witnessed a second volcanic eruption over the weekend that destroyed several houses in the fishing town of Grindavik. The population was evacuated again hours before this latest eruption, and an emergency was declared in the area. Andrea Eivarsdottir is a resident and the town's library director. She spoke to the BBC when the volcano first erupted just a week before Christmas. Evan Davis caught up with her and asked her how she felt after this latest one.
This is like a really, really strange situation to be in. And my feelings are very, very torn between, of course, wanting everything to be okay, but also at the same time, just wanting an eruption in town to just get this over with. Because after this eruption that started yesterday, I don't think that we are ever going to be safe or feel safe in town again.
You don't think you could move back?
No, there is no way that I'm moving back. I watched three houses from people that I know personally go up in flames when the lava engulfed them. And I'm never going to put myself or my sons in this situation.
Andrea, just talk me through the gritty sort of detail of insurance. I mean, if your house is burnt down, I'm presuming there's insurance. Either the state or the insurance company pays for it, does it?
Yes. So we have what is called a national natural disaster insurance, which is paid by the government. That insurance goes into act when there is earthquakes or avalanches or volcanic eruptions or any natural disaster that takes out whole houses. So your house has to be like completely ruined by the event itself for the National Natural Disaster Insurance to come into effect. But my house is fine. It's not ruined. It's not even badly damaged after all of the earthquakes. But our normal insurance, as soon as a natural disaster starts to happen, those insurances are void because the natural disaster insurance should take over. But if your house is fine and it's still in an area that is uninhabitable, like Grindavik is at the moment, we are like sort of in between those two insurances. And we are getting nothing.
And if you don't go back and you don't get insurance money to pay out because your house isn't going to be damaged, probably, what are your choices? You basically have to kind of start again, I suppose, do you?
Yeah. So there are a few possibilities. I'm almost 47. So I have a lot of money invested in my house, but I'm still young enough to be able to start again. But to start again, I would have to declare bankruptcy because either I would have to keep on paying off the mortgage of the house in Grindavík and rent in Reykjavík, and there is no way I can do that. So I would have to file for bankruptcy if I don't get bought out by the government.
Andrea Eyvars-Dottir speaking to Evan Davis from Iceland. Italy's government has been caught up in a scandal after its junior culture minister was accused of possessing and exhibiting a stolen 17th century painting. Vittorio Sgarbi has been put under investigation for laundering stolen goods. He's also being questioned about the illegal export of another painting. He denies all the charges. Our correspondent in Rome, Mark Lowen, takes up the story.
Vittorio Sgarbi's career as a junior minister, art critic and TV personality has been peppered with convictions for slander during his often foul-mouthed outbursts. Now he's in even deeper legal hot water. The politician is being investigated for owning a work called The Capture of St. Peter by the 17th century artist Rutilio Manetti, which was allegedly stolen from a castle in northern Italy in 2013. He's also accused of adding the image of a candle to the corner to hide its authenticity. Mr. Sgarbi says he found the painting in a villa bought by his mother and that the canvas cut out of the castle was a copy. Now he's facing accusations over a different work, one attributed to the French painter Valentin de Boulogne, with an estimated value of 5 million euros, seized by police in Monte Carlo. Mr. Sgarbi is being investigated for its illegal exportation. He claims it's a copy which he did not own. Opposition parties have called for Mr. Sgarbi's dismissal. He went on Italian TV to defend his actions, with language too colourful to repeat.
Mark Lowen in Rome. It's been 14 years since the cult video game series Prince of Persia last had a new edition, but the latest reboot makes an extra effort to respect Iranian and Persian culture. Here's our reporter, Ella Bicknell.
Think 1001 Nights, mixed with a bit of Indiana Jones and a touch of Robin Hood. Prince of Persia is an action-adventure video game franchise beloved by millions since its first launch in 1989. In 2010, it was adapted into a Hollywood movie, and its characters have even been immortalized as Lego figures. But it wasn't terribly, well, Persian. So the developers, Ubisoft, wanted the latest in the series, The Lost Crown, which is out this week, to better depict Persian mythology and Iranian culture. The reboot is available in Farsi, and the gameplay weaves in elements of the Zoroastrian religion, which was founded in what is now Iran. The game's producers told the BBC that they're very proud to have made the changes, and it's gone down well with fans, with some saying it's a huge step forward in showing a culture that's often underrepresented in Western media.
Ella Bicknell. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Sasha hated sand, the way it stuck to things for weeks. So when Maddie shared a surf trip on Expedia Trip Planner, he hesitated. Then he added a hotel with a cliffside pool to the plan, and they both spent the week in the water. You were made to follow your whims. We were made to help find a place on the beach with a pool and a waterfall and a soaking tub and, of course, a great shower. Expedia. Made to travel.
I'm John Ronson, and I'm back with Season 2 of Things Fell Apart. my show for BBC Radio 4 that unearths the origin stories of the culture wars. This time around, the stories are all about the battlefronts that engulfed us during lockdown. The stories twist and turn until each one ends with the explosion of a new, far-reaching culture war.
If you tell me that my nephew had superhuman strength, if you tell me that he didn't feel any pain, well, he's dead now.
That's Things Fell Apart. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.